There were so many needs for money. Daniel sat silent while they debated passionately the greatest needs for the stolen goods. "Leave that to Roche," he broke in finally. "It is for the cause." The argument ended. They were perfectly satisfied. Looking at the circle of intense, swarthy faces, at the flashing eyes, feeling the unquestioning loyalty that bound them all to Roche, Daniel cursed his own heavy misgivings. Why could he not be satisfied with his own answer? Nor were the villagers satisfied. Every day in the shop, in the marketplace, at the door of the synagogue, one heard the name of Roche, sometimes bitterly condemned, sometimes as hotly defended. At last, Roche's name was on every lip, as he had once predicted. Some swore he was the defender of the Jews, but others pointed out that he had turned against Jews. But though they muttered, most men clung with blind faith to Roche. They still looked to the mountain as the stronghold of freedom and hope. The relay of messages, which had succeeded so well, was now intensified. Yuel threw himself into the role of fish peddler, and with experience, he grew more shrewd in interpreting the bits of gossip, the signs of activity that he picked up in the doorways and kitchens of the city. Because he could not often leave home in the evening, other members of the band brought the messages to Daniel's shop. At night, Yoktan crept down the slopes like a jackal, across the cucumber field to the watchtower, and back to Roche with the day's report. A mounting excitement filled the watchtower, where boys met nearly every night in the week. Here at last was something to do. Now they could see the results of their work. For the results were never far behind. Roche had acquired at last the link with the city for which he had waited. The boys had given him a weapon he needed, and he struck far and wide, with suddenness and cunning. Yuel learned of a Galilean merchant who was expected to deliver 7 cruses of oil to the centurion's household on the morrow. Though the merchant set out from his vineyard before dawn, neither he nor his oil was ever seen again. A bridegroom, son of the wealthiest elder in the synagogue, left the city with a gala party of his friends, laden with gifts, to claim his bride in Sepphoris. The bride waited in vain. Next day, the whole party returned to their homes, clad only in their tunics, bereft of their handsome cloaks, their gifts, almost of their senses. A holiday party, returning late by torchlight from the games in the theater at Tiberias, was routed, stripped, and badly beaten. For none of these victims did the boys feel the slightest pity. Any trader who sold his goods to the Romans did so at his own risk. Those who flaunted their wealth or patronized a Roman theater were fair prey, and every cruse of oil, every silver talent swelled the fund that would soon maintain the army of Israel. As Roche grew bolder, caravans and travelers increased their protection. The mountain outlaws also suffered losses. 2 more men fell into Roman hands, 3 were secretly buried after night attacks, and 4 more nursed wounds in the cave. Roche needed more recruits. Thus it came about that the boys were admitted at last into Roche's active service and came to see the action they had craved. Not the trained army that Daniel had dreamed of marching to confront Roche. Only a guerrilla force of 19 eager boys. They met at the watchtower, coming one by one, crawling on hands and knees through the tangled vines, to wait, on fire with impatience, for a summons from Roche. Throughout the village, there was a sudden rash of bandages. Boys limped with a swagger, leered smugly through purpled eyelids, and grinned through swollen lips. To harass the Romans was their real delight. A pilfered bit of Roman equipment, a spur, a leather gauntlet, was a prize worth risking one's neck for. One city boy, who'd made off with a helmet even while a legionary who had laid it aside stooped to take a drink at the well, was almost as great a hero as Yoel himself. Much of all this, Daniel watched with dismay. It was not for this sort of skirmishing that he had dreamed of raising a band. To him, many of the exploits they boasted seemed childish. It had been his plan to wait, to train, to grow strong, and then to strike. This activity was like a fire lighted too soon. Would it burn itself out before the day had come? But even he was proud of the catapult. Two boys brought word of it one evening, rushing into the shop out of breath.
"Right on the road, they've left it," one of them panted. "Only two guards. It's one of the big engines they used in the siege of Sepphoris. A wheel crumpled, and they've had to leave it there till morning."
"I'll tell Roche," said Daniel, laying down his hammer.
"Wait, let's take care of this one ourselves," the other boy suggested. "What could Roche do with a catapult? Come on, Daniel. We discovered this. Why can't we have some of the fun for ourselves?"
"We can stuff it with oiled rags and set fire to it.
What a bonfire that would make." "Enough to be seen for miles," Daniel reminded him. "No use to burn good wood."
"We're in need of supplies, not bonfires."
"We'll take it apart then," they decided.
Before he could make up his mind, they had taken the lead out of his hands. The word went out. Hurriedly, they scrambled together weapons, files from the shop, chisels, and mallets. One at a time, by various routes, they made their way to a point overlooking the Via Maris and looked down at the monster that crouched there like an unearthly beast in the darkness.
"What do you suppose they're moving that thing for?"
someone whispered.
"I've a good idea," Daniel answered. "It's the kind of thing Herod used against the caves at Arbella."
"You think they'd dare to attack Roche?"
"If he makes enough trouble for them."
"All the more reason," said the boy. "We'll do away with it."
"Wait," cautioned Daniel. "The guards are not to be killed. It would mean death in the village. I'll take one of them, Nathan takes the other, the way I've taught him." Before the guard knew that anyone was near, Daniel had one arm about his throat. When the man lay, stunned and gagged, Daniel relieved him of spear and dagger. A moment later, a sharp whistle announced that the second guard also was overcome. One by one, shadowy figures crept from the rocks and surrounded the monster. They worked silently, muffling under their cloaks the rasp of the file and the chipping of the chisel. Bit by bit, plank by plank, the monster shrank and crumpled. Over and over, during the long night, the boys retraced the devious path to the watchtower, staggering under heavy planks and crossbeams. When the sun rose next morning, the catapult had disappeared without a trace. Nor did Roman offers of reward or threats of reprisal produce a single hint of its whereabouts. The boys were wild with success. They swaggered through the village, taking little pains to hide their barked shins and blistered palms. Daniel tried to warn them. "You will ruin everything," he urged. "This is only the beginning."
"Why?" they demanded. "Why can't we strike now? Look at the people. Would one of them give us away? They are just waiting. One word and they'll be with us. Why doesn't Roche give the word?"
Yoel sent warnings from the city. The Romans were strengthening their forces. A detachment of foot guard had come up from Tiberias to join the garrison. The road patrol had been doubled. Even in the village, unfamiliar soldiers strolled, apparently without purpose, their eyes alert under their helmets. Daniel insisted there would be no nightly activity for a time. The boys, chafing under the restraint, went scowling about the village. There was an explosive quality in the air. One morning, a shepherd hurried into town with word that three of the town flock had been snared and slaughtered. That morning, two men visited Daniel's shop.
"They say you can get a message to Roche if you choose," one began.
Daniel did not answer.
"If you can, tell him this. He is to leave our sheep alone."
"Do you begrudge a sheep now and then?" asked Daniel quietly. "To the man who would give his life for your freedom?"
"We have had enough of his brand of freedom. He's free up there, free from the taxes that bleed us dry, free to play with the Romans while we stand and take the punishment. By the prophets, if you have any fondness for the savior of yours, warn him now. We have had enough.
2 days later, a farmer, about to move with his family to man the watchtower in his field, came upon his near-ripened crop and found it plundered, trampled, wantonly ruined. Dismayed, Daniel climbed the mountain to take the warning to Roche, only to have Roche laugh in his face.
"They are afraid of their own shadows," Roche jeered. "What good are they but to raise food for men who will fight?"
"They are desperate," Daniel urged. "You know they cannot carry arms themselves. They are going to appeal to the centurion for protection. They want him to send legionaries."
"Let them come," Roche boasted. "Let them get a taste of the mountain. They will only break their teeth on it."
Daniel went back to the village, sick at heart. "We must hurry," he thought with despair. "The whole village is turning against him. If the day does not come soon, they will never follow him."
18. The Bronze Bow. Late in the afternoon on the last day of the month of Ebol, Daniel, looking up from his work, saw a figure hurrying along the road, an unfamiliar figure, muffled in a heavy turban and moving with a haste that warned him of trouble. He put down his hammer and waited. It was only when the stranger entered the shadow of the doorway and pushed back the turban that he saw it was Thacia. Who could have imagined that Thacia could look like this? Stricken, gray-faced, the wet hair clinging to her forehead.
"Oh, Daniel," she gasped. "They have taken Yoel."
"The soldiers?"
"Yes. Oh, I knew from the beginning that this would happen. What can we do?"
"I knew it too," he thought, with a wave of sickness. "Where is he?"
"In the garrison. He didn't come home all night. This morning I went to the harbor and couldn't find him. I didn't know what to do. So I went to Kemuel, and he managed to find out. They had been suspecting the centurion's kitchen slaves. Yesterday 5 slaves were flogged, and when Yoel came to the door they took him."
"Did Kemuel find out any more?"
"They're sending some prisoners east in the morning. They've sentenced Yoel to go with them."
"Does that mean the galleys?"
"Daniel, Yoel could not live in the galleys. He..."
Through his own horror, Daniel saw that the girl was close to collapse. Numbly, he reached out and touched her shoulder. "Roche will have planned for this," he said. "He will know what to do." At his touch, she began to weep wildly, her hands covering her face. "She has borne this all night," he thought, "and all day. Has she eaten or rested?" Through the open door to his house, he saw Leia, standing behind her loom, staring. How much had she understood? With one arm across her shoulders, he led Thacia to the door. "Take care of her," he said to his sister. "I'm going up the mountain." Leia came from behind the loom and held out her arms, and Thacia stumbled into them. The golden head bent gently over the dark one. In 2 hours' time, Daniel reached the cave. The thorn fire was blazing, and the fragrance of roasted mutton hung in the air. The men who sprawled on the ground barely glanced at him. At the mouth of the cave, Roche sat, rubbing at a fine ivory-handled dagger. He listened, giving more attention to the blade than to Daniel's distraught message.
"He was getting too confident," he grunted.
"They can't know who he is," Daniel urged. "Yoel would never let them know his father's name. They'll think he's only a fisherman. They won't be looking for an attack."
"Attack?" Roche repeated coldly. "What are you talking about?"
"If we move fast, we can surprise them on the road."
"We?"
"All of us will help you. You can count on us."
"Speak for yourself," Roche said. "It's not my affair."
Anger exploded in a red blaze before Daniel's eyes.
"Yoel was following your orders," he shouted. "You're responsible for him. Roche still rubbed at the steel. On this mountain, every man is responsible for himself. That holds for Yoel.
Daniel held back his rage.
Listen to me, Roche. He struggled to speak reasonably. 8 of us took Samson. From the Romans? Use your head. We took Samson from some scurvy traitors. Roman soldiers? That's another matter.
Desperately, Daniel tried a different tack. Yoel is important to us, he argued.
Important? He was stupid enough to get caught. You think I can spare 8 men, or 1 man, for that?
Daniel's control gave way.
You'd just use him and then let him go? Without even a try?
Roche squinted up at him.
I've warned you before, he said, his voice ugly. There's a soft streak in you. Till you get rid of it, you're no good to the cause.
The red mist of anger cleared suddenly from Daniel's mind. He looked at the man who had been his leader. He saw the coarsened face with its tangle of dirty beard. He saw the hard mouth, the calculating little eyes. He saw a man he had never really looked at before.
The cause, he said with despair. How could you know what it means?
Fury mottled the man's face.
Take care, you. Don't threaten me, Daniel said. I am not one of your men. Not any longer.
Roche coiled back.
You fool! He spat out. How far could you get without me?
Daniel looked steadily into the narrowed black eyes. In another moment, Roche would spring at him. At the prospect, his hands clenched with savage pleasure. But his mind was in control now. He could not fight with Roche. The very strength of his hands he owed to this man. And what good would it do Yoel? He turned away without speaking and passed through the ring of silent, wary men. He knew that he was through with the mountain forever. As he went down the trail, footsteps came pounding after him.
Daniel, wait!
It was Yoktan.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to get Yoel.
By yourself?
No, there are 19 of us.
To 20,
said Yoktan. He had drawn himself up to his last skinny inch.
Let me go with you,
he pleaded, before Daniel could refuse. Daniel decided quickly.
Come then, he said. You can't be worse off.
Even in his haste, he felt a sharp disappointment and regret. He had hoped that the footsteps were Samson's. He would have liked to say goodbye to the big man, to clasp the man's hand, to try to tell him not to watch anymore. But this too he must put behind him. He and Yoktan had the trail to themselves. But as he went down, the uncanny feeling grew on him that someone was behind. Had Roche sent someone to follow him? Time and again he whirled about, but he could see nothing. His skin kept prickling. He quickened his stride till Yoktan was running to keep pace. In the watchtower, 12 boys waited in the darkness, making no sound. One by one, others crawled through the field to join them. Kemuel had summoned every boy in the city.
What is Roche going to do?
They greeted Daniel, their faces sober. They read the answer in his silence.
Nothing?
Nathan cried out, incredulous.
After Yoel has...
His voice broke. The others stared at Daniel, too stunned and angry to speak. I have failed them all, he thought. They trusted me.
What does it matter? Kemuel suddenly lashed out with scorn. We don't need your Roche, your great leader. We'll do without him.
Tumult exploded in the watchtower, anger flaring instantly into new hope.
Wait!
Daniel silenced them. Let's have one thing clear. Maybe some of you think, as Roche does, that every man answers only for himself.
We answer for each other,
Nathan spoke swiftly. A dozen voices echoed him with passion. Kemuel cut sharply across the clamor.
Do you have a plan?
Yes, said Daniel. At once every boy was quiet.
For 19 against a Roman force?
20,
said Daniel, his hand on Yoktan's shoulder. If we use our heads, we can make 20 count for 100. We won't try to fight them. We will only get Yuel.
How?
Confidence had come back to their voices.
On the road.
Daniel's mind was working clearly now. We can't break into the garrison. We can't afford to meet the Romans face to face. We can go south, beyond Magdala, and wait in the pass near Arbela. On the cliff, we can spread out and throw down rocks, so that they won't know how many we are. The Romans have no reason to expect an attack. When we have stirred up as much confusion as we can, then we take Yuel.
How?
They questioned. He will be chained.
That's a blacksmith's job.
There was a silence.
One cannot do that alone, said Nathan. I'll go down with you.
Before we go on, said Daniel, we must have a leader. Up till now, we have all been equal.
We have already chosen, said another boy. You have always been the leader.
Not by a vote.
There's no need to vote, said Nathan. Does anyone here question who is our leader?
Not a whisper challenged him.
Then you will obey my orders, said Daniel sternly. He felt no pride or glory that he was their leader, as he had once dreamed, only a cold heaviness. The time has not come to fight the Romans, he told them. We have no right to waste lives that are needed for the cause, even for Yuel. You are to stay on the cliff and distract the soldiers while I free Yuel from the chains. Then you will all retreat as fast as you can. I don't think the Romans will follow. They'll be leery of a trap. This time they kept silent, not questioning his command. Take all the weapons you have, he ordered. We'll start now and find our place. He hesitated, feeling awkward, but compelled to speak. Yuel is the one who has always read us the scriptures. Now we'll have to remember the things he has read. Eudes and Jonathan and Simone went out with a few against the enemy. We can do it too. The same God will strengthen us. In the darkness, each boy reached out and clasped the hand of the one nearest him. For God's victory, they said together solemnly.
19. The Bronze Bow. Before dawn, the boys had found their position. In the darkness, they had followed the shore road south past Magdala, striking inland to a place where the Via Maris, the road the Romans must follow to the coast, wound between steep, almost unscalable banks. There they worked their way painfully upward and hid behind rocky projections to rest. With the first light, they ventured out, only one boy showing himself at a time, to collect the stones that would be their weapons. A very few carried spears and daggers. By the time the sun was fully risen, every boy was well fortified and concealed. Even during the night, there was traveling on this main road to the sea. During the early morning, they counted 5 large caravans, with long files of burdened camels. Families, tradesmen, sometimes small detachments of soldiers passed beneath their hiding place. This had long ago been a dangerous section of road. But now travelers passed with confidence because, more than 50 years before, the great King Herod had wiped out the robbers who dwelt in the caves of Arbela, and now a Roman wall flanked the heights. So long had it been since bandits had inhabited this place that now Daniel dared gamble that the Romans would have no suspicion of attack. On the steep cliff below where the boys were stationed, Daniel found the spot best suited to his own purpose. A fissure in the rock extended in an oblique line down the face of the rock, wide and deep enough in some parts to hide several men, ending on a narrow shelf barely 10 feet above the road. In the crevice that dipped below the level of the rocky shelf, he posted Nathan and Kemuel. "I'll free Yuel and lift him up to you," he told them. "You reach down and pull him up. If any soldiers follow, use your spears. Only one can climb up at a time, and I think the second will think twice before he tries.
How do you get back?
Nathan asked, looking closely at Daniel.
When Yoel is up, then give me a hand, Daniel answered. He had no real expectation that he would get back up the bank, but he meant to see, with the last ounce of his strength, that Yoel did.
Nathan opened his mouth, then closed it, seeing in Daniel's eye a reminder that they had chosen a leader. Through the noonday heat they waited, their energy draining away bit by bit under the merciless sun. As the hours went by, Daniel's foreboding deepened. This waiting was not the same as the times he had crouched behind a rock eager for Roche's signal. It was no flimsily guarded caravan they awaited. And behind him was no tight-knit band that would move with precision and cunning, only a cluster of untried boys. Even now, as he glanced up, the flutter of a coat sleeve betrayed one of them. Still, he could count on them. He knew that every boy in the band was prepared to give his life. It was up to him, the one they had chosen leader, to see that none of them had to. But how different this was from the glorious battle they had hoped for. Would the day ever come when together they could pit their strength against the Romans for God's victory? Daniel put that thought aside. A more immediate worry was the uneasiness that had persisted all night, the feeling that he was followed and watched, even in the darkness. Could it be that in setting a trap for the Romans, he had led his band into some other trap? Almost, he was tempted to call them back. But there was Yoel. At mid-afternoon, Yoktan brought the warning. He alone, of all the band, was trained to this kind of attack. He wriggled and dodged his way along the roadside and skinned up the cliff into the crevice.
Horsemen, he gasped. About eight. Then foot soldiers. Then the prisoners.
Did you see Yoel?
No. Too far away. But they've come a distance. The horses are lathered.
Daniel gave two sharp whistles, the alert they had arranged, and looked up at the bank.
Climb up there, will you?
He growled to Yoktan, pointing. Tell whoever that is to pull in his rump before he gets a javelin in it. That would get Yoktan also above the danger line, he reckoned. The first horseman swung into view, moving slowly to keep pace with the footmen. The cavalry rode in pairs, their spurs almost touching in the narrow pass, erect, silent, the plumes of their helmets rising and falling with the horse's pace. Would the others remember? The horsemen were to go through. Daniel tensed. He felt a vast relief as not a sound or motion betrayed the boys on the cliff. Behind the horsemen came the foot soldiers, in a double line. He watched them pass, one steely face after another. He counted 16. Then shuffled the prisoners, chained together by the ankles in a long line. Yoel was the fifth, barefoot, disheveled, his feet dragging. Between him and the rock marched a guard with a heavy whip. Behind the prisoners, there would be more foot soldiers. Daniel held his breath. When Yoel was nearly below him, he gave the signal. The first rock hurtled through the air and found a mark. A foot soldier stumbled. Instantly, the air was flecked with rocks. An order crackled back across the line. As one man, the Romans raised their shields above their heads. Four men broke from the rank and charged up the almost vertical rock. A stone caught the first in the chest and sent him reeling back. A spear struck the second cleanly. But the line behind them resealed itself into an unbroken, purposeful unit. Daniel's heart sank. He had guessed wrong. The Romans were going to charge the bank, and the boys could not possibly hold them back for long. But in the same instant as his shout for retreat, a thunder drowned out his voice. Jerking back his head, Daniel saw with horror the great rock that teetered on the opposite bank, ripped from the cliffside, and crashed down, gathering speed and force, carrying with it a roar of dirt and stones. Stupefied, he watched the leaping, frenzied soldiers. There had been no one on the other bank. What had dislodged the rock? Then he glimpsed a shape, huge, crouched like an animal, dodging on all fours along the bank. For one flash, he saw the powerful arms, the massive dark head. Samson! But how? Abruptly, he came to his senses. Now was his chance. With a thrust of his arms, he pulled himself up to the shelf of rock and leaped. As his feet found the path, he sank his dagger below the shoulder of the guard, and as the man crumpled, dropped to his knees before Yuel, pulled out his chisel, and reached for the chain. The first blow of the sharpened tool left a nick in the iron. He struck again, and saw the nick deepen. Confusion swelled around him. The prisoners were screaming now. He heard a second thudding roar, but he did not look up. As he raised his arm for a third blow, he felt himself seized from behind, in a paralyzing grip, lifted clear off the ground, jerked upward like a helpless sack. For an instant he hung in the air, and then he struck against the rock. Pain whirled him in crazy circles, and through the pain he felt hands clutching and pulling, scraping his flesh along the rock. A heavy body struck squarely on top of him. Legs thrashed about his head, and blackness crashed down on him. He came out of the blackness into the blinding sun. There was rock under him, and pain zigzagged through his body. He blinked, trying to focus through the glare. Near him, he made out a figure, Yoel, sitting with his knees drawn up, his face buried in his arms.
"Don't move!"
a voice warned. Kemuel's face blocked out the sky.
"They've about cleared out."
Memory came back suddenly. He jerked up and sank back again, helpless against the pain. He saw now that he was in the crevice of rock, but higher up the bank.
"Careful," Kemuel warned. "You've got a broken shoulder bone, I think. Maybe a couple of broken ribs. Yoel was luckier. He landed on top of you. He's got hardly a scratch."
Daniel's hand groped for his head. It had an unfamiliar shape.
"My irons hit you," Yoel said, his voice sounding weak and dull.
"Good thing," Kemuel spoke to Yoel. "How could I have got him up here?"
Daniel pulled himself up.
"The soldiers?"
"Gone. But there may be a guard."
"They didn't come up the bank?"
"No. I think the leader went down with that rock. They never got organized again."
The rock.
"Samson!"
Daniel cried out, remembering.
"I saw him up there."
Yoel and Kemuel looked at each other. Daniel tried to shake his mind clear.
"How did we get up here? We were on the road."
Neither boy spoke for a moment.
"You didn't see?"
Yoel asked finally.
"Not after they jumped on me. Not the soldiers,"
Yoel said.
"It was Samson. I thought at first it was another slide coming down. And then he was there. He threw you onto the rock. Right over his head. Then he got hold of my chain and twisted it open with his bare hands. And he pulled me free and threw me up on top of you. Nathan and Kemuel pulled us down inside."
It was Samson who had lifted him. And Samson who had been following all night, not knowing what they were going to do, but knowing that they could not do it alone. And Samson, the stupid one, who had hidden on the other bank and routed the soldiers. Daniel stared sickly back at Yoel. He made himself ask,
"Where is he?"
Yoel's eyes met his squarely.
"They took him. He was wounded. A spear hit him even before he had the chain open." "He might be still..."
"No," said Kemuel. "They dragged him with them. He didn't even fight them. He was..."
"You don't need to worry about the galleys, Daniel. He won't live to reach the coast."
Daniel turned his head away. Then he saw Nathan, sprawled with his face against the rock, the blood gathered in a blackened pool beneath him.
"He leaned too far out to pull you down," said Kemuel.
Nathan, whose bride of a few weeks waited in his new house. A sob suddenly twisted Yoel.
"Why did you do it?"
he choked.
"I'd rather... You should have let me..."
"How many others?" Daniel asked.
We couldn't see the others. Can you walk, do you think? We can climb back to where we planned to meet.
I can walk, said Daniel. Crawling, wriggling along the crevice, pulling themselves by fingers and toes, they finally reached the top of the cliff.
Daniel lay panting, almost blinded again by pain. When he was able to look about him, he saw that five gray-faced boys lay flat on the cliff's top. During the next endless hour, 12 more slowly wriggled their way to the meeting place. Finally, they were all together, all but Nathan. They lay in hiding till sundown, not talking much. After the darkness fell, four of them went down to the crevice for Nathan's body. They could not hope to take him home with them, so they made a grave on the cliff and left him there. Then slowly, wearily, one at a time, they crept down to the road and made their way north like ordinary travelers. They shared a deep thankfulness that Yuel was with them, but the might of Rome, seen close at hand, had shaken them. They knew that without Samson, they would have failed, and the eager confidence of the night before would never be regained.
20. The Bronze Bow. The month of Tishri brought the first autumn rains. The parched brown fields drank in the moisture. The soil fell back, dark red behind the plow, rich for the fall sowing. In the roads, after a sudden shower, the puddles shone like pools of melted lead. There were no meetings in the watchtower now. The boys of the band moved cautiously, not daring to be seen too frequently with each other. Soon, they whispered as they passed. They would begin again. They would build up once more their store of weapons. They would make ready for the day to come. But there was no eagerness in the whispers. They knew in their hearts that the day would not be soon. They had lost faith in the mountain. In the steaming dimness of his shop, Daniel labored to the limits of each day's strength. Unable to lift the hammer, he filled his time with light tasks, filing, smoothing, and polishing, trying to ignore the pain in his shoulder. He cursed the pile of untouched work. He longed to beat a wall of furious sound against his own thoughts. At night, in the roof shelter he now shared with Yoktan, he drew his cloak over his head and fell into an exhausted slumber. But always, during the long hours, he woke to the slashing of rain, and then the pain could not be ignored, and the thoughts were louder than ever. In the darkness, the same words echoed over and over. Those who live by the sword will perish by the sword. At first, he could not recall where he had heard these words. They did not sound like Yoel's scriptures. Then he remembered. Jesus had spoken them on a hot summer morning under a blue sky. Daniel had not questioned the words. To live by the sword was the best life he knew. To take the sword for his country's freedom and to perish by it, what better could a man hope for? But something he had not reckoned on had happened. He had taken the sword, but Samson, instead, had perished by it, who had no freedom to gain, and Nathan, who had left behind a bride. Their deaths were on his head, and freedom was farther away than before. Without the help of Yoktan, he could not have managed. The boy, who had come back to the village with him, could not do enough to prove his gratitude. Having never in all his memory had a house to live in, Yoktan was not at all troubled that he could not enter Simone's house. He was content to eat his meals in the shop or on the doorstep, where he could greet the passers-by. Far from missing the freedom of the mountain, he took naturally to village life. He went cheerfully every morning to the well for water, shrugging off the good-natured jibes of the girls. He delivered the work, making new friends everywhere with his jagged-toothed grin. Daniel's customers took the boy for a new apprentice and praised his willingness, though they doubted that with his puny arms he could ever make a blacksmith. 9 days had gone by since Yuel and Thasia had returned to Capernaum, and no word had come from them. Day after day, his friend's silence grew heavier to bear. Was Yuel in danger? What were Yuel's thoughts in the night, Did he regret now the vow he had taken? Had the feel of the Roman chains shaken his purpose? Late one evening, as he was about to climb on the rooftop, there was a knock on the door of the shop. Lighting a second saucer of oil, Daniel went through the house door and drew back the bolt. A stranger, heavily muffled in a dripping cloak, pushed in quickly and shut the door behind him. With a rush of thankfulness, Daniel saw that it was Yoel. He could only clasp his friend's hand without speaking. "Did you think I wouldn't come?" Yoel asked with surprise. It seemed wiser to wait.
"You are watched?"
"I'm afraid so. I've been out only once, on the Sabbath. Coming home from the synagogue with Father, I met a steward of the centurions. He recognized me, but I think he was not sure. So Father wouldn't let me go out again."
"Your father knows?"
"I couldn't keep it from him any longer. I told him everything about the passageway and the meetings and my part in Roche's work. I owed Father that, Daniel. When I saw how he had grown older in those 2 days..."
Yoel had grown older, too. His face had a new purpose.
"How he must despise me," Daniel said with shame.
"For saving me? He sent you a message. He says you are not to hide in the passageway again. You're to come to the house whenever you like. In a way, I wish he hadn't tried so hard to forgive us. It would have been easier tonight."
"Tonight?"
"I left without telling him. I'm not going back. If I can't stay here with you, I'll go to the mountain and join Roche." In a burst of relief and joy, Daniel forgot every doubt. How could he have thought that Yoel would forget his vow? Now, working together, they could accomplish anything. The band would go on again, stronger than before. But almost at once, a new doubt clouded out his pleasure. "Why did you leave home, Yoel? The band has never asked that of anyone." "I can't stay at home. Father is terrified to let me go out the door." "I knew he was making some plan. Then today he told me I was to go to Jerusalem. Tomorrow morning, with a friend of his. He's arranged for me to study in a school there. So I had to get away quickly."
Daniel stood looking at his friend, his mind troubled.
"School in Jerusalem?" he asked soberly. "Isn't that what you always wanted?"
Yoel did not quite meet his eye.
"I used to," he admitted. "That was before we started the band."
"Don't you still want it?"
"I want to work for the victory. I vowed to. If you can't have me, if it isn't safe, then I'll go to the mountain."
"Roche is no longer our leader," said Daniel. Yoel hesitated, then said very earnestly,
"You must not break with Roche because of me."
"It would have happened anyway," Daniel answered. "I've had a lot of time to think these past days. Somehow we've been going in the wrong direction. The things we've been doing for Roche weren't what we planned when we started the band. Attacking people on the road, especially our own people, isn't going to bring the day any closer. We haven't weakened Rome at all. We've only weakened ourselves instead. We have lost Nathan and Samson. We almost lost you."
Yoel was silent a moment.
"A new leader will come," he said. "We must go on making ready."
"Yes," said Daniel.
Hearing Yoel say it had given him back the hope he had almost lost. Now he was able to say the thing he knew he must say.
"But until he comes, Yoel, you must go on studying. That's what you are suited for. When the day comes, we're going to need more than farmers and laborers. We'll need the priests and the scribes, too. And you can win them over because you understand them."
Yoel had never been able to hide his thoughts. Now he could not conceal the hope that sprang into his eyes.
"That's what Thashia said," he admitted. "Are you sure you mean this, Daniel?"
"I'm sure."
"What will the others think?"
"They have chosen me leader."
Yoel thought for a moment. "I'd like to do it for Father's sake, too," he admitted finally. He's a good man, Daniel. You can't know how good he is, because you've only seen his narrow side. I know that I have hurt him. He wanted to be proud of me. A son who died for Israel. Even a zealot, he could be proud of that. But that day on the road, with the chains on, I knew that I had left him nothing, nothing at all to be proud of. Now you and Samson and Nathan, have given me another chance. I'll never forget that. I'll do my best to make up for it.
Can you get back safely tonight?
I think so. But there are some things I must say first. For one thing, I brought a gift from Thashia to Leah. She won't be able to come here alone. Right now, she's forbidden to leave the house at all.
Leah will be grateful, Daniel managed, trying to hide his dismay. You all hesitated. Do you think Leah would let me give it to her myself? He asked.
You can try, Daniel answered doubtfully. She has seen you often through the door.
He opened the door to the house. Leah, sitting in the lamplight, raised her golden head.
Yoel has brought you a gift from Thashia, he said.
He waited. Behind him, Yoel stood quietly in the doorway. Leah seemed to shrink into a tight mold of fear. He could see her quiver, but she did not move, only watched with terrified blue eyes.
Thashia sent her greetings.
Yoel spoke very gently.
She asks you not to forget her, and she will come to see you as soon as she can.
He reached out and softly laid a packet on the chest near the door. Then he backed into the shop, and Daniel followed him.
You realize, Daniel said with wonder, that you're the only person who has been inside that door, ever, except for your sister?
Thashia told me to try.
Leah is very lovely, Daniel. I wish...
Thashia sent you a message too, by the way.
Daniel felt his cheeks grow hot.
4 days from today is the Day of Atonement. First the fast, of course, and then the service at the synagogue.
Why? I never thought. I'll see it at the temple in Jerusalem. I can't believe it.
But I'll miss the festival here in Capernaum. The girls will dance and sing in the vineyard.
Will you come to town for it?
I wouldn't know how to behave, Daniel protested.
Think it over. It would please Thashia. Now, the other thing is about Leah. Thashia and I want you to know that you never need to be worried about leaving her, because we will take care of her. When the day comes, if you ever have to go away, Thashia will come. Or even better, we would like to have Leah safe in our own house.
He hurried on, while Daniel groped for words to thank him.
Thashia is very fond of Leah. She'll miss her. Thace is going to be lonely, I'm afraid.
Daniel looked down at his hands. Father regrets now that he's allowed her so much freedom to go about with me. Thace is spoiled. She isn't used to staying at home the way most girls do.
It will be like caging a wild bird from the mountain, Daniel thought.
Yoel looked away then, into a far corner of the shop.
Father wants to arrange a marriage for her, he said.
Daniel was not even aware that his hands reached out or that his knuckles whitened around a hammer handle.
There is an old friend of the family, Yoel went on, but Thashia won't hear of it. It puts Father in a hard position because, no matter how he regrets it, he is bound by his own promise. You see, it's different with our family. When our mother was only 8 years old, she was betrothed. But when she was 15, my father, who was a poor student, came to do some work in her father's library, and they fell in love. It caused a terrible uproar. Her father was furious. He had to get divorce papers from the boy she had never even laid eyes on. She and father promised each other then that they would never arrange marriages for their children against their will, that they would let us choose for ourselves.
Daniel did not dare look at his friend.
The trouble is, Yoel said, Thashia is 16 years old, and she refuses to choose. Still, Daniel could not look up. He knew that Yoel had spoken straight from his heart, with the impulse of frankness that would always be Yoel's way. But he knew, too, that his friend's loyalty had always blinded him to the truth. "She must choose," he burst out now, too harshly. "Someone of her own kind. Your father is right, and you will have to choose too before long."
"And you?"
Yoel asked quietly.
"I have no choice. How can a man who is sworn to vengeance and death take a wife?"
The angry words echoed in a silence that neither of them could seem to break.
"One more thing,"
Yoel said finally, with an effort.
"It is Jesus. Somehow he must be warned. He has enemies everywhere."
"You mean Herod's men?" asked Daniel, relieved that Yoel had turned to a safe subject.
"He knows about those. I mean the elders of the synagogue, the rabbis and the scribes. They can't understand him. They're furious at the things he says and does. He is too free with the law. They say he is trying to destroy all the authority of the temple. Some of them even say he is in league with the devil."
"Does it matter what they say? Jesus pays no attention."
"He must pay attention now. Some of them hate him so much. I think they would kill him if they could. Will you try to warn him?"
"Simone says he has been warned time and time again."
"Go to see him, Daniel. I wish, but it's too late for me now. Perhaps we made a mistake. Maybe Jesus is really the leader we're waiting for."
Then he straightened his shoulders and held out his hand.
"Don't forget the festival anyway," he said. "Thace will be looking for you."
The two clasped hands.
"For God's victory," they said.
Then Yoel drew his cloak about his face and went out into the darkness.
"It is the end of everything," Daniel thought, looking at the closed door. "The end of everything we worked for." For the first time, he despaired that the day would ever come.
21. The Bronze Bow.
"It was good of you to come, Daniel. But do you think Jesus does not know all this?"
Annoyed, Daniel looked back at Simone. He had walked all the way from the village at the end of a long day's work. Twice, a slanting rush of rain had drenched him to the skin, and the night air, heavy with fog, had only chilled him and not dried the clothing that clung to his body. He had fought his way through the tattered crowd in the garden, and now that he had reached the door, they refused to let him approach Jesus. The teacher, they explained, was conferring with important men who had come all the way from Jerusalem to question him. Now Simone brushed off Yoel's urgent warning with no more than a shrug.
"Forgive me, Daniel,"
Simone said now, seeing that he had offended his young friend.
"We are worried, too. These priests from Judea. They haven't given him a moment's peace for 3 days. They pretend to be so respectful, and they're only trying to trap him into saying something they can prove is blasphemy. It keeps us all on edge.
Why does he stay here if he knows he is in danger? Why doesn't he hide till he's strong enough?"
"The people need him. Come another time, Daniel. I cannot talk tonight."
With the door shut against him, Daniel stood in the crowded garden. He wanted desperately to see Jesus. He knew now that the warning had been only an excuse. If he could have one word, one sign from Jesus, he might find the strength to go on working. For a long time he waited, lost in his own misery. Finally, Andrew came to the door of the house and looked out.
"No use to wait," he called to the wretched crowd. "The master is very weary. He can see no one else tonight."
A wailing filled the garden. Then gradually the sick and the lame, convinced that the man had meant what he said, began to hobble back toward the road. A few simply settled themselves on the damp ground, having no other place to spend the night. Presently the door opened again, and Simone and Andrew and Jesus came out into the garden. They moved slowly, and Jesus spoke kindly to those who obstructed the way,
touching them sometimes with a pitying hand. Firmly, the two disciples pushed away for their master to the outside staircase that led to the upper room. They stood watching till Jesus, carrying a small nightlight, ascended the stairs, went into the shelter, and closed the door behind him. It was dark in the garden. When the disciples had gone back into the house, Daniel moved forward and stood at the foot of the staircase. He could not bear to go away. He was sure he had not made any sound, but over his head, the door opened. "Who is there?" Jesus spoke. He raised the lamp. Daniel did not dare to speak, but almost without thought, he moved into the small circle cast by the lamp and raised his head till the light fell upon his face. "Come up, my friend," said Jesus softly. The upper chamber was completely bare and clean. On the floor was unrolled the thin mattress on which Jesus was to sleep. "Sit down," said Jesus, and he himself sat, opposite Daniel, on the floor of rolled earth. "Why are you troubled?" he asked. "I came to warn you." Daniel hurried into his errand. "Yoel says you are in danger. He says they have turned against you in the synagogue. He's afraid they will try to kill you." "Thank you," said Jesus gravely. "It is kind of you and Yoel. Now, tell me, why are you troubled?" Shamed, aware that he should not disturb the master's rest, Daniel sat struggling with his conscience. Then his misery spilled over. "Because I don't know where to turn. Everything has failed. Everything I hoped and lived for." "What did you live for?" "Just one thing. Freedom for my people, and vengeance for my father's death." "Two things," said Jesus. "Not one. They are the same. I will strike for both at once." "Are you sure?" Jesus asked. The familiar tightness pulled at Daniel's mouth. He had come for help, not questions. "All I wanted was a chance," he went on. "I thought it had come at last, and I worked and planned for it. Then it all went wrong somehow. All I have is another debt to pay. Samson." Jesus was silent for a moment. "This Samson," he asked, "he was your friend?" The question surprised Daniel.